all here. I'm going to talk about core collapse supernova remnants, probably a little bit of zealotry. I'd like to thank my co-zealots here who've worked in a number of areas with me on this. No, this is not working. All right, I think that'll work. There we are. Okay. I'm old enough to remember the pre-modern era of X-ray astronomy. The modern era began with Chandra and XMM in about 1999. This is a picture of Cass A, taken from the very early time, one of the early light observations of Cass A, of Chandra. And this is the X-ray spectrum indicating a range of different species that we see, elemental species. One can examine the spectrum as a function of position, and what one sees is a broad range of different types of spectral types. Spectral classes. A silicon-rich class, an iron-rich class, another iron-rich class, and then a class of non-thermal emission. This early data already indicated evidence that iron-rich material had overturned silicon-rich material, at least on the eastern portion of the remnant. Equivalent width maps done with a much deeper observation shortly thereafter showed a very similar effect. This is a broadband image in the X-ray covering the Chandra band. This is an equivalent width map made in the silicon line, in which you just take the line flux and divide it by the estimate of the continuum underneath. And this region out here, which has been known for many years as the site of the optical jet, turns out to be rich in silicon, while the iron emission turns out to be predominantly in this eastern lobe and then in a northern lobe. Further evidence regarding the nature and distribution and velocity of the various components in Cass A came out from a very nice Doppler imaging study done by Willingell et al. With XMM. And what I show up here are velocity encoded maps of silicon and sulfur with the coding down here. The velocity is basically colored in this pattern of color with a region here of velocities of, say, minus 2,000 up to minus 2,000, and then velocities near zero in the northern lobe. Silicon and sulfur are very similar in their velocity structure. The southeast knots are sort of blue-shifted. These are moderately red-shifted. And the knowledge of the silicon velocities, at least in these the lobes here, the difference between these lobes, had been known about for a long time, even since the Einstein Observatory focal plane crystal spectrometer measurements. And also studies that were done with the Chandra data as well indicated the presence for these two different types of velocity components in the silicon and sulfur. What was new, really new with this, was the evidence for iron, in which the eastern lobe was shown to sort of have a similar velocity pattern to the silicon and sulfur, but the northern lobe indicated somewhat more positive velocities in this northern lobe than the silicon and sulfur case. And so what these authors did was to look at the way the different species, silicon in red, sulfur in green, and iron in blue, how they were distributed first in the plane of the sky, showing the iron preceding the silicon on the eastern limb. What they then did was to use the velocity information to rotate this view around so that you're looking from this direction. And in that case, you're now looking at the distribution of matter in the northern lobe, the center of the remnants here, and the iron, as you can see, is again out beyond the silicon and sulfur-rich stuff here. So what this work sort of shows is that, in general, the two broad blobs or lobes of ejecta we see in Cass A seem to have had their distribution of species inverted. So that was a very, certainly an interesting and exciting area of study, which has led to a lot more work on Cass A. And so I'm going to go through this sort of subsequent work that is relevant to determining both the dynamics of Cass A, this locations of the fluid discontinuities, and information on how the ejecta are distributed, and how asymmetries in energy and mass may have occurred during the explosion. So this is an image of Cass A taken in only the continuum band, 4 to 6 keV continuum, that highlights relativistic electrons that are probably produced by diffusive shock acceleration. And what Gotthelf and his collaborators did was to trace the location of the outer edge using these thin filaments that are seen around the rim here as the location for the shock. And that's sort of shown here. A surface brightness profile is shown here with an enhancement near that outer rim. Not as much enhancement in the line emission, which comes from the ejecta. An obvious jump in the radio intensity, and then a very nice evidence for a change in the polarization angle of the radio. And so from this information, these authors were able to determine the radius of the forward shock, given in arc seconds there. They also determined the location of the reverse shock by taking the both the silicon surface brightness emission and the radio surface brightness emission and deprojecting it using a simple geometric deprojection model. And they were able to arrive at a radius for the reverse shock of about 95 arc seconds. Now, the ratio of these radii, forward to reverse shock, turned out to be a value of about 3 to 2, and those circles are put on top of the image here, the Cas A image. This ratio is actually an indicator of the dynamical state of the remnant, and these authors suggest that it indicates that the swept-up mass is less than but comparable to the amount of ejected mass. And this caveat associated with that is that this assumption assumes inefficient cosmic ray acceleration. So the next step is to determine not only the location of the shocks, but to determine the proper motion of those shocks. And that was done by Delaney and Rudnick a few years ago. And what they did was to study a number of different features around the rim and watch how they moved over the course of a couple of years using two separate Chandra observations. They found that the rates vary quite a bit around the rim, but have a medium value of about 0.21% per year. At the radius of the shock in physical units, that applies a velocity of about 5,000 kilometers per second. And using an age estimate from optical studies, it was possible to determine the expansion parameter, which shows how the radius evolves with time's power law, of about 0.69, which is intermediate between the set-off assumption and the free expansion assumption. There's also a lot of other variation in the motion of the knots in the interior here. These knots we're talking about are the outer knots for the forward shock, but there's a lot of where the X-ray emission is very bright, there's also a lot of motion going on in there. And in fact, what was interesting is that the previous expansion measurements of Cas A, using lower resolution devices, the ROSET HRI, for example, produced similar expansion rates based mainly on the bright ring of emission here, the ejector ring. The rates are very similar to this rate in the forward shock. So in a subsequent article, Delaney et al. Looked at the rest of the remnant to determine proper motions across the whole remnant using a high-resolution Chandra data. And what they did was to identify four separate spectral components. Two of these I talked about before, silicon, iron dominated. These are ejected components. And I also talked about the continuum dominated component as well here. The spectral components are shown in black, and the red just shows sort of the average spectrum, I guess. And then this is a new component that these authors identified in which they called low energy enhanced. And this is just a crude picture of their tomographic mapping of these different components. So what they then did was to determine the proper motions as a function of spectral type. Now, the optical ejecta, which they didn't do, this has been published, the optical ejecta, the fastest moving optical ejecta, appears to be moving close to the free expansion rate, which is about 0.3% per year for Cas A. The silicon and iron dominated component show similar rates to the forward shock. Okay, so the silicon and iron are similar to each other. They're shown here. I'm plotting the number of knots that they found, that they studied, versus the radial expansion rate here. And the silicon knots are shown here. Iron dominated knots are shown here. Quite similar to each other and quite similar to the forward shock expansion rate. And that's consistent with what was found earlier for the expansion of the bright ring. X-ray dominated knots expand slower than the optical, but faster than the radio, in the same region, co-spatial features. These are knots of covering the same region of the remnant. And so what these authors argue is that deceleration has to be a function of the density of a knot. So they basically explain why the remnant in different wave band shows different expansion rates. Their low energy enhanced component has a very slow rate, shown here, close to being at rest, which they argue comes from the clumpy wind, the progenitor's clumpy wind. And then they have interior continuum filaments, which are different from the exterior filaments shown here. And these continuum interior filaments show a wide range of speeds. And the idea they have is that you're looking face-on a wrinkled, clumpy medium, and the forward shock just has an apparently chaotic from place to place. Okay, so these sort of set, these previous studies sort of set the stage for a couple of very nice detailed studies of the ejector structure, explosion asymmetry, and nature of the iron knots in CASA, based on two papers by some of our organizers here, Martin and Una. And the models are indicated here, based on Shulevin-McKee hydro approximation, an expansion of that, stellar wind profile, uniform density core with a power law envelope. In this particular case, the study of knots along here and here, the assumption was that the composition was oxygen and silicon rich, the product of sort of oxygen burning. And the models include the relevant evolutionary effects, time-dependent ionization, Coulomb timescale for equilibration of the electron and ion temperatures, and then losses due to radiation and adiabatic expansion as the knots evolve after being shocked. And so the technique is to build models, shown in curves here, for how the ionization age and temperature of individual knots will evolve as a function of the index, n equals 5.5 in this particular case, how the index of the envelope, power law index of the envelope distribution varies. Build the models and then compare to observations which give us the measured temperature and ionization age for a set of knots. Martin and Una argue that knots from the jet base, indicated here in boxes, suggest a low value for the index, n of 6 or 9, 6, I'm sorry, or less, and while knots from the east limb suggest a higher value. I encourage you to look at Jessica Warren's talk, or stay for her talk on Friday, where she'll actually show some recent work that we've been doing trying to compare our knot fits to these types of models. And the long and short of this very nice paper is that the differences found in the jet base versus the east limb can be explained by an explosion asymmetry, and that factors of two more energy going into the jet direction than the equator is sort of what is consistent with the results. The next, in their second paper, they study the iron-rich ejecta off on the eastern limb of the remnant here, a number of different spots here. And what's very nice about this is that they're actually able to translate the properties of the knot seen out here to what their mass coordinate was in the star just after exploding. And they find that the mass coordinates is about two solar masses. So in other words, they're about a third to 40 to 50% out in the ejecta, the iron knots, including, and then one includes a compact object as well to get this total mass. So these iron-rich knots are actually further out in the ejecta than where they were originally produced. They make the point that radiative cooling would make iron knots that are even further out in terms of mass coordinate invisible in the x-rays now. So this is sort of a lower limit to where the mass coordinate is. And then the other point they make is that the a pure iron knot came from this box here. This is nearly pure iron, which is likely from alpha-rich freeze-out, which occurs at the innermost ejecta. And just identifying this knot is very important. And the fact that they furthermore find that its Lagrangian mass is very similar to the Lagrangian mass of the other knots. What doesn't radiate in the X-ray?
But I didn't explain tomorrow that the temperature, you predict the temperature.
I mean, if you wanted to get into the details of how much continuum from hydrogen you can include there, I mean, we could get into that as well. And I would say that there's probably a significant fraction of hydrogen continuum you could squeeze in if you wanted to. So there is an element of zealotry in this, perhaps. But it's also an element of you know, what makes sense, also. Yeah, especially, I mean, there's very little, I mean, you can fit silicon emission here, but it's quite a lot less than you see elsewhere in the remnant. Likewise for sulfur, and this has been, I'll talk now about the megasecond observation. Unfortunately, I don't have a spectrum of the megasecond observation, but that iron, pure iron blob sharpens up in the sense that the statistics reduce significantly, but we don't add any additional lines. It basically becomes even more convincing that it's completely dominated by iron. Whether it's pure iron is something that you need to take on faith. So the megasecond observation was done a couple of years ago by Chandra, million seconds. One of the results that came out of this in an early study that we published a couple of years ago is a clear presence for a counter jet. Is indicated along here. This is a heavily burned-in image. The main jet up here, and then evidence for the counter jet back here. Also evident in a set of line ratios that we made, showing a enhancement in this line ratio in this direction as well as this direction. It's not exactly clear why, other than the fact that the jet has a particular composition, which is similar. The jet composition. The spectrum of the jet on this side is very similar to the spectrum of the counter jet over here. Oxygen and silicon rich spectrum. So it is likely, the arguments are in this paper, that the jet originated in the explosion and less likely to be due to cavities in the circumstellar medium, sort of an asymmetric wind. Allowing for the eject to expand more rapidly in these directions. It's more likely it is a jet. And then the other point to note is that the compact source... These lines, yes, these were added. These were added to denote the... that's a good point. Well, you're right. It has a larger. It seems to have a broader opening angle. Sure. We don't really understand why the jet comes out in this direction, but it seems to have. It seems to be somewhat broader if you consider the blue region here than over here. Yes. Yeah. It's magnesium and iron to silicon to magnesium to iron. Right. It turns out that this image is something that pops out of a principal component analysis that we do to the whole data, and it Jessica will show that on Friday as well. And that is sort of an independent. That's not a biased way of generating line ratios and significant spectral components. Yeah, I think it's we should have an energetic discussion about the nature of these features out here versus the features over here. And I think perhaps we can learn about searches for optical components to the jets over here. But first, let me finish. So the compact star does not seem to be perfectly aligned with the jet or counter jet, although it seems to line up with components or separate pieces in it. Oh, the compact object. Yes, the compact object. it's unpulsed. There's no optical counterpart and no surrounding wind nebula. It looks quite nice in this picture, doesn't it? We can now reject the power law model for the spectrum, and the black body fits indicate a small emitting area and a modest luminosity. But there's also this very interesting result that came out about a year or so ago, based on Spitzer, MIPS 24 micron scan, indicated here. What this shows, this curve here shows, this figure shows the difference of images taken 2 years apart, showing significant evidence for rapid luminal expansion in various of these infrared emitting knots here. I didn't really believe it until I saw this ground-based K-band image showing a filament sweeping across the sky at the speed of light. So the argument that is that there's there was a flare, an energetic flare, from some compact object, presumably the compact object in the center of Cassay, about 50 years ago, and that's in order to match the geometry of the motions, and that we're now seeing the light echoes, the infrared light echoes from dust that was heated up by that flare. The isotropic energy required in order to produce the luminosity we see is something like 10 to the 46 Earths. So, to summarize, yes, 5 minutes. Okay, we won't do many more than Cassay. This is a little bit too busy. The iron-rich ejecta lie beyond the silicon ejecta in the east and the north. Talked about that. There's a pure iron ejecta knot indicating complete silicon burning. Only a few percent of the iron ejecta are currently visible in the X-rays. We've detected nuclear de-excitation lines. There's a jet and a counterjet. Maybe I should have put quotations around those. Modest opening angle, 10 to 20 degrees. Parts of the jet are aligned with the compact star. It's a compact star. It has an inferred kick direction, which is perpendicular to the motion of the optical jet. The compact source is not a young, energetic crab-like pulsar, and there was possibly a quiescent soft gamma ray. It's possibly a quiescent SGR with a giant flare about 50 years ago. Now, the explosion energy inferred from the model, the study I talked about earlier, is a few 10 to the 51 Earths, possibly varying by a factor of 2 with position. And then I was able to glean from studies that people believe the mass of the ejecta is a few solar masses. There's a compact object with perhaps the mass of a neutron star. And then the circumstellar medium has of order 10 to 20 solar masses in the circumstellar medium. All right, now I have some more material about some other type of core collapse supernovae, but I would hesitate to present that, start presenting that now. But what I should say in summary of that work is that Cassay is really unique. It's different from all the other core collapse supernovae that we know, supernova remnants that we know, which tend to be dominated not by iron and silicon but by oxygen, and in fact appear to be dominated by the products of hydrostatic burning rather than explosive burning, as we see in Cassay. Okay, I'll finish there.
Couple of comments. The expansion parameter M 0.69 is very close to the Sedov-Taylor limit for a stellar wind circumstellar medium. It's in between. It's in the transition region if you have a uniform. So that means that if you believe there's a stellar wind there, which of course there's all sorts of evidence for, the ejector mass should be much lower than the swept up circumstellar mass, which is what the estimates are giving, which implies we think that it must have undergone a high degree of mass loss before explosion. And that's what makes the Cassay remnant unique among the core collapse remnants we see.
I know we've spoken about this before, but I also put the numbers together for EO102, which is one of these oxygen-rich remnants in the Magellanic Cloud. And the oxygen mass we get from the HET grading data is about 6 solar masses. But that's an upper limit. They don't assume it's clumped. Any clumping would reduce that. And I just calculated hydrogen mass in the wind to be about 15 solar masses.
In one EO2.
In EO102.
So that has significant mass loss, you know.
As well,
yes. But it's still got enough mass on the progenitor for the reverse shock to be going through the outer layers.
Right,
and
only through the outer layers.
We think Cassay lost a significant extra amount, so the reverse shock is now into the inner ejector, which is what makes it so interesting.
From the off-center position of the central compact central object, what is the, if you would infer a kick velocity, what would be the kick velocity of the central, of the central object from the jet?
I don't remember the number.
And then the second question: Would you conclude that magnetar, gamma, whatever ejection from magnetar are highly collimated? If you have to explain the Spitzer data. And the last part of it, if what was the angular range that was covered? Because the picture stops about 20 parsec away from the question whether there are other lobes farther away. I mean, this is the end of the picture, but did Spitzer look farther off to see whether these lobes are extending in the same direction?
I can't say whether or not they did. I'm not sure. I don't know if they looked in other directions.
So it is like the normal kick velocity of neutron stars.
Jack, are the opening angles for the jet, is that measured with respect to the central compact source, or can you actually measure that from the edges of the jet itself?
How do we measure that? Just by laying lines down, right? I don't think we actually tried to put the lines through the compact star. But they're really rough order of magnitude.
Jack, you mentioned about the iron being outside the silicon and sulfur and the overturning of, you know, the ejector, maybe some asymmetries or something. Are there other supernova remnants which show something similar? Any core collapse? I know in Tycho they said something, but that's a different one. Any core collapse, other ones would show something similar?
No, a lot of the other remnants show a much more orderly progression, a much more homogeneous composition, more oxygen neon dominated. I'm thinking of the southern remnant, G292, and then the remnants in the Magellanic Cloud, small Magellanic Cloud, EO102.
But do they show like heavier ejector outside the lighter one?
No, they seem to show about the same composition everywhere. Let me show you, if I may. This is EO102, and blue, this is mainly oxygen-rich stuff, oxygen and neon-rich stuff. And the color variation here, a little bit of red, a little bit of blue, is mainly due to change in the ionization and thermodynamic state in ejector with roughly the same composition from place to place. And this other remnant here, G292, is also the blue stuff again is oxygen, neon, and magnesium dominated stuff. Here's a spectrum of this small blob down here, dominated by neon and magnesium and silicon. Those are the only lines you see. And I hesitate to say this, but in fact, we believe it's a pure knot of oxygen, neon, magnesium ejecta. Although we can, in fact, squeeze some continuum in there, it's also possible to fit it without any continuum. So, and the knots that we see in this particular remnant are very homogeneous. They have very similar composition to this. And their variation from point to point are due to thermodynamic variations. So I don't know of any other remnant where we actually see this kind of a concentration of iron-rich ejecta, silicon-rich ejecta, in a core collapse supernova, plus this overturning business. Yeah, I mean that. Sure. Nice interpretation.
So, do you have any upper or lower limits to the iron mass?
In which?
Cas A, for example.
No, I don't have an upper limit to the mass. Do you want to get into that, Martin?
We estimated a few percent of the total thing. If you expect to detect the total of about 0.05 solid mass of iron, you're seeing a few percent of that.
Oh, the visible iron, sure, it's just a few percent. Yeah.
Okay. And is there any compact remnant information? And that's oxygen rich one.
Yeah, there's a nice compact 135 millisecond pulsar in this guy. It's got a few 10 to the 34 erg per second in the wind.
So when you say there's no oxygen, people are not living with that.
I'm sorry, when I said No, I shouldn't have said that we don't see any oxygen in Cass A. It's a dominant component as well. We just don't see the strong oxygen line like that we see here. But we believe oxygen is a very important component in Cass A.
As a matter of fact, I wanted to make a related comment. We've been seeing how, you know, all this X-ray spectra have this prominent lines from different elements. And I want to stress the fact that it's very, very hard to go from an X-ray spectrum to something like a quantitative limit on the actual mass of each element that you're seeing, because the underlying dynamics of the remnant, which can be very complex, have to be taken into account. So many of those estimates about masses and, you know, this is more oxygen rich or less, have to be taken with a grain of salt.
I'd like to stress that Cass A is very important because there's no neon and magnesium, or very little neon and magnesium, compared to all those other remnants you're mentioning. And oxygen-rich remnants like Cass A are supposed to have a lot of neon and magnesium, and it's maybe a factor 10 less than models predict. And I think this is very peculiar about Cass A. Not so much, because there's not that much iron L as well. I mean, otherwise you could have a sort of, you know, crosstalk between them, but actually there's not that much iron L as well. But iron L seems to be okay for a typical core collapse supernova. Something like maybe 0.1 solar mass would do it. But neon and magnesium are really underabundant. And actually, Rob Fiesen has shown that there is at least one neon-rich knot in the optical, but that's really only there is. So both the optical and the X-ray don't show a lot of neon and magnesium. Yeah, but what is the mass? I mean, of course there is. Yeah. Yeah. You can see it, yeah.
You can trace out, it's a, well, the brightness variations are the same as the optical, but you trace out all the same optical structures.
But what I remember is there are some forbidden neon lines and argon lines, so you tend to see those very well in the infrared, but that doesn't mean that there is a lot of neon and magnesium there, right?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
The fractal dimension. Well, yeah, it's very interesting. When I talk about type 1a supernova remnants, I show Tycho and 1006, which show a beautiful, fluffy kind of appearance compared to this guy and then Cass A, which are explosions and ugly and messy and highly fragmented. We played around with a little bit, defining contours, taking the power spectrum with a contour, taking power spectrum of two-dimensional images. It's hard. Maybe fractal dimension or some other term would be type. And it also depends on what band you're going to look in, if you look in silicon and iron, and those differences are really great. I've tried to get Roger interested in doing power spectrum of some of his models, his n-dimensional models, so I haven't tried really hard.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, if there's no further questions, then let's thank the speaker one more time.